There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is May 14th. My name is Sarah Jesmer, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ganigahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, and we will be right back.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First news. Quebec health officials announced this week that they won't be using the AstraZeneca vaccine anymore for their COVID-19 vaccine programs. The Thursday decision said some people can choose it as a second dose. Vaccinations open today, May 14th, for all adults older than 18 years old at clicsante.ca. And there's warfare in the Gaza and Jerusalem region. The longstanding conflict between the settler colony of Israel and the indigenous Palestinian nation grew to immense intensity after Israel recently started clearing out a specific neighborhood, Sheesh Shera. Montreal residents marched outside the Israeli consulate this week in support of Palestine. They say this is a case of ethnic cleansing and apartheid, and that the two nations are far from being on equal footing. We'll be hearing from experts about this later on in the episode. And the English Montreal School Board is canceling classes until next Wednesday as ongoing union negotiations continue. This comes at a time when Premier François Legault tabled Bill 96. His administration aims now to change the Canadian Constitution by making French the only official language of Quebec. It'll also cap enrollment at English CEGEPs and strengthen a complaint process if someone is not served in French at places like businesses. And this week marks the start of Eid al-Fitr. It's a three-day Muslim holiday that marks the end of Ramadan, a fasting period during the holiest month of Islamic faith. And on Tuesday, Quebec's Minister of Immigration, Nadine Guilbeault, acknowledged that the processing time for provincial permanent residency applications stands at 27 months. Wait times in other provinces are close to 6 months. This was announced in the same week as the annual deadline for international students to submit their study permit applications for the fall semester. And immigrant rights groups like workers' associations have been protesting for months in Montreal for status for all and to end labor laws that they say leave them without protections or choices. Gaurav Sharma was one of these demonstrators who spoke at a rally last month in Peace Park.
All person are working over here. I'm also working here. They are less demanding because the workers who directly hired by the company are essential. We are not because we are from the agency. This is the discrimination. We have to stop this thing. Are you agree with me?
Yeah. He's from India and now lives in Park Extension.
We are working equally. They say you are from agency, so that's why you fired. So my demand from the government is the agency should not be interfered. The agency should not be over here. Agency not here. Everyone should have a right. Everyone should directly hire an equal work, equal pay scale, equal demand, equal everything.
The group he's here with have been maintaining an ask for 7 things from Canadian officials. The Immigrant Workers Centre want 1, status for all. 2, to open access to the Quebec Experience Program to everybody. 3, to make realistic language requirements. 4, to create fairness in job recruitment. 5 and 6 are health and public benefit access for everyone, regardless of their status. And lastly, to protect international students. This is CKUT. This is a track called Mestreme by Montreal-based artist Chiquita Magic.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Sarah Jesmer. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we're going to talk about a report that was released in January of this year. This is going to be a segment that talks about some difficult topics like murder, racism, and assault. Like reports that have been written about this topic, this has been created to stir a sense of urgency. This segment will not add any new information to what has already been reported about missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, trans, and Two-Spirit friends, relatives, and loved ones. If you'd rather read than listen, you can start at mmiwg-ffada.ca. Again, that's mmiwg-ffada.ca. And if you have any information on someone who has gone missing in the Montreal or Jaujage region, a tip line was created this week to centralize that information. That number is 855-547-5938. 855-547-5938. Week 1. Week 2. Week 3. There There have been more than 4,000 Indigenous women and girls that have been murdered or gone missing in the last 30 years. That's about 133 a year, or 3 women in 1 week. Brandy Morin said this, a Cree, Iroquois, French journalist based in Treaty 6 territory in Alberta. These are not stats. These are people. Tiffany Morrison, a 24-year-old mother and sister from Ganawage. Donna Perret, an Inuk woman in her 30s. 31-year-old Ashley Morin. 15-year-old girl Tina Fontaine. High schooler Felicia Solomon. The 16-year-old cousin of Cree teenager Helen Betty Osborne. Women, girls, trans, and two-spirit people. These are friends, daughters, and sisters. While each woman has her own story, their collective disappearances are an ongoing genocide and a human rights issue. Indigenous voices from coast to coast, federal officials, global rights organizations, and councils like the UN all say so. This is a crisis that has been studied carefully in the last decade because it keeps happening. The list of recommendations about how to act in response for justice for these missing women is easily in the hundreds. In Quebec, for women here, studies like the Vienne Commission, the Quebec Native Women Report, the National Inquiry Final Report are just a few that aim to change things.
There's also like the Soul Sister Report from 2002 by Amnesty International that also spoke.
That's Jessica Chiano, the coordinator of the Ishkwe program in Montreal's Native Women's Shelter. We'll return to her words in a moment. Chiano hears and sees the issues at hand daily, about the specific cases of disappearances, about the words from families, and also the inaction of people in power as an official response. Mary Hanneberg is the vice president of Quebec Native Women, an organization by and for Indigenous women in this region. She's Gunigahaga from Gunasatake. She says the problems that cause women to disappear are just one part of the larger equation. The other is what happens after a woman goes missing. That's two different conversations about the same thing, Indigenous people's safety. Hanneberg.
Well, we have our women that are going missing and whatever's happening to them, they had to pay with their absences and the suffering to their family to bring it to light that we're not being protected by the people that are put in place to do the protection, that are have the responsibility, that are getting salaries to do it, but they're not doing it. We need to have some answers. We need to have some resolve on this. Yes, it is a human rights issue. That's right.
Quebec Native Women, as an organization, worked to answer some of these questions about how this crisis across Turtle Island or North America manifests here in this province. Their findings are called Stand With Us. But 5 years later, they teamed up with professors at UQAM in Montreal to see how local systems react to these disappearances, specifically the city's police department. That document was published in January of this year, just a couple months ago. Maria Trilsch was one of those UQAM researchers.
In the beginning, we thought this was going to be about the nuts and bolts. You know, we thought it was going to be about finding out, you know, what are the procedures that the SPDM follows and how could those procedures be improved? Like, what are the procedural problems in the reaction of the SPVM? And then we went about our interviews with different community organizations, Indigenous organizations, and mostly what we heard was actually that the problem is a much more fundamental one, that it's not about the nuts and bolts, it's about, you know, it's the foundation that is rotten.
They sought to answer a question about what's happening between community and police in Montreal, or Jojage. Jojage is what this island is called by its original custodians, the Gunigahaga or Mohawk Nation, who never ceded it and still call it home today. But to understand what this newest report means, you need to go back a few years. As Chiano said, in 2002, Amnesty International released a Stolen Sisters report. It tells the stories of women like Cree student and teenager Helen Betty Osborne. Helen went missing in the Paw in Manitoba in the 70s. She was found killed and assaulted by 4 white men. Not only was her death a deep tragedy felt across her community, but courts found that the police failed to investigate properly and quickly because of a lack of concern about all the missing cases in the PAW and their own racism. Why? Helen's not the only one who was treated this way. And the 2002 report was just one of the first. Its findings echoed over and over again. In 2015, the first official talks began on the federal level about starting an inquiry to look hard at these cases across Canada. Some cases open, some sloppily closed, some not even recorded. In the same year, the Montreal Urban Aboriginal Community Strategy Network, or The Network, joined the police force in Montreal, or SPVM, to sign an agreement. It was supposed to solidify a commitment to work together to improve safety for Jojage's Indigenous residents. One of their four explicit points of agreement was to do a better job at preventing and responding to cases of missing Indigenous women. The 2015 agreement was signed by Nakuset. She runs the Native Women's Shelter and is co-president of the Montreal Urban Aboriginal Community Strategy Network. Mark Parent also signed, who at the time was the head of the SPVM. Parent retired, as he had long planned, from the force just 2 months after this ink dried. Around the same time that this agreement was being signed by Nakuset and Parent, Quebec Native women was looking into what was happening province-wide. They saw a verifiable lack of data about what happens to women and their cases in eastern provinces, despite there being women and girls going missing. Their 2016 report, Stand With Us, says, quote, "The history of Indigenous peoples in Quebec consists of a chain of disappearances linked directly to both the Canadian and Quebecois governments' policies of assimilation and erasure. Today, these disappearances, defined by participants as the vanishing of a loved one under unknown circumstances, take on different forms, of which murder is the most serious and definitive." End quote.
The stigma of Indigenous women, and also the labeling of, oh, well, they're high risk, oh, they're just gone out partying, you know, those are the things that would be very detrimental, because people would lessen, they would lessen the importance of the person and actually downplay what is happening. We know that the predators are very much aware of the vulnerabilities of some women, and that they prey on these vulnerabilities and they target these vulnerabilities. They manipulate this. So even if we had a runaway, they are still at very high risk. The gaps are the reporting and the collaboration between the province, between the police forces, the various bodies of police agencies, not working all together, not doing a concerted and a very efficient turning over of information and sharing to, I guess, speed up the process of trying to find an individual who has gone missing. So these are the things that we need to watch out for.
Stand With Us mentions hopes for what could have come out of the 2015 agreement between the network and the SPVM. Quote, "Though it's still too early to speak about the impacts of this agreement, such collaborations are encouraging and could no doubt be adapted and reproduced elsewhere in the province." End quote. But the 2015 agreement didn't live up to expectations, says Keanu.
When talking to other organizations, and it has been a failure. The agreement, it really has not really improved relations between the Indigenous community and the police.
She's the expert. 2 years after it was signed, she was hired to be a liaison between the community and the police for these cases, to make a report, and it doesn't have to be after the 24-hour mark. A family member or friend tells an officer. If they do not want to interact with police, the agreement says the coordinator at the Ishkwu project will be the stand-in. That's Keanu. She works with police on almost all of the cases of missing women here.
Probably all of them. I mean, I would think that, I think so. I think most of the cases that I get, unless there's somebody I haven't heard about, but usually the SPVM will forward me cases if they get a missing case to assist the family. In most of the cases, and usually the police are, they're open to the help. It's not that they don't want any assistance.
The police got a liaison officer too, after the network agreement was signed. That's Carlos DeAngelis. So it's Keanu on the community side and Carlos DeAngelis on the SPVM side. But there's way more to the picture than just Keanu and a group of officers. You can think of the SPVM like a group of four buildings on the same campus. The SPVM is 31 neighborhood police stations split into these four buildings. They're able to work independently from each other. In silos, you could say. But they all have access to the same resources, like searchable databases or the simple ability to drive out to go see if someone's okay. That's why they're part of this equation.
And they have access to a lot of technology. So I need police when I have a missing person because they can access to see if they've been hospitalized or in detention.
Communities and families also solve cases for themselves just by talking to each other. Searching thoroughly doesn't take a badge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we use police because there's no other options that are there. I have located people that have gone missing through contacts in the community. We're even going to be putting out a 1-800 tip line that is for the Indigenous community, because right now we have info crime, but people don't use that. So it just speaks volumes to the trust that the community has with police.
This has been the norm since policing began. It's understood that there's a deep problem of mistrust between public services used by Indigenous people in Quebec and the people who give them.
This systemic racism that is it's encrusted in these institutions. And with all the training and all the education, that's great. You know, a lot of people say, well, we need to do some training, sensitivity training. I think it has to be more. It has to be more where there's observation of the practices of the police, where they have to focus on what is being done, weed out the racism and the ones that have the racism or are not doing their job as if it would be their own family member, and make sure that, you know, these people don't continue on because they are adding to the problem. And, you know, when we look at and I'm going to bring up Joyce's principal, Joyce Eshequan.
Joyce Eshequan is an Atikamekw mother. She died in her 30s in a Quebec hospital after staff that were supposed to care for her made racist remarks about her instead. Joyce's principal is a document created by her home community in Atikamekw. It guarantees equitable access to health and social services for all Indigenous clients. It was not adopted by the Quebec National Assembly. Top provincial settler leaders refused to acknowledge the existence of systemic racism in the province.
When we look at the remarks that I've made, it's not only in the healthcare system. It's often in society, and it's often in the institutions that are there to supposedly provide services. There's no conjointed database, and I think it's important that they work with the families. This is very important. The gaps is they do not work with the families. They do not report, you know, on the various findings. It is getting better, but it's not where it's supposed to be. I could say that it's not, because a lot of time lapses. And the more that a time lapses, the more vulnerability and high risks that the women are. It's the timing. It's the discrimination, it's the systemic racism, and it's also the attitudes. And it's not only going to take training, it's going to take someone to oversee the practices in ensuring that we're getting the quality service just like anyone else.
When contacted for comment about this topic, the SPVM said, quote, "We must all the same recognize that we are, as an organization and as a society, at the prelude of a reconciliation which will require continuing our efforts in order to better understand the realities of Indigenous peoples and to offer a response adapted to their needs," end quote. More about what they said later. 2 years after Keanu was hired in 2017, the Vienne Commission came out. It reiterated what Indigenous people have already known, that Quebec's public services, like hospitals and justice systems, routinely and purposefully discriminate against them. If a woman doesn't trust the police, she's more likely not to go to them if she's in danger. The very final countrywide national inquiry final report came out in 2019, too.
I now would like to invite Ms. Verna Polson, who's the Grand Chief of the Algonquin Nation, to please come forward to bring greetings from the territory. Verna.
Kwe. Hello. Bonjour. Good morning, everyone. Today is a historic day. I'd like to thank all the families who are here and gathered on our sacred territory, the Algonquin Anishinaabe Nation. I welcome all of you. I woke up this morning and I always try to recap of what I'm going to say. I always speak from my heart and I'm for the people. I wear this medallion today for the women, for our girls who are missing and who are struggling today. My medallion keeps pushing on one side all morning. I keep moving it. It's moving away from my heart, it says, because there's so much work yet to be done. There's much justice needs to be done. My earrings keep flipping. I take this as a sign when my medallion moves and my earring moves, they flip, they move. We need to continue this work together. And I also need to acknowledge the elder who did the ceremony this morning. Ceremony is a part of who we are, our identity. We need to continue doing these ceremonies together, nation to nation. Learn from one another.
The recommendations combined for changing systems that came out of 2019 was over 300 that could be applied to Quebec alone. Hannah Berg.
And we, you know, today we would hope that we would make some headway. You know, having gone through what we've gone through in the past while with, you know, the different things that have come in and all the different reports and the Royal Commission and then another report and the missing and murdered women and all those recommendations, those are calls to action. Why till this day can we not work together? Can you not include? We know we have expertise. We have, you know, we could be an asset, but no, it's not warranted. It's not wanted. You know, so until that foundation is changed, I don't see us having a very good ground to stand on.
Hannah Berg says this latest UCAM partner report uniquely hyper-focuses on Montreal, not broadly on Quebec, like the 2016 Stand With Us inquiry. But her thoughts during the interviews and documentation process were...
Well, how could that continue on for such a long time as such and nothing be done about it? That was what it is. It was like basically... becoming aware of the enormity of the problem and the lack of concern. That was very hurtful.
Enter 2021.
I'm pretty tired. I mean, I'm not going to go testify anymore at any inquiries. I'm not really interested in participating anymore in researches because it's been done. And my colleagues and myself, we're very exhausted. We're just, you know, we have it all here.
And the situation that has been known by Indigenous families, neighbors, and organizations has gotten worse today, says Hannah Berg. According to a 2016 study by the U.S.-based National Institute of Justice, for 97% of Indigenous women who have experienced violence, it's been done by someone who is not Native. Indigenous women and girls are 5 times more likely to experience violence or go missing than any other population in so-called Canada.
And right now, you know, we need it so much because the numbers are increasing. And, you know, we don't see a lot of action. We don't.
Perhaps one of the most telling developments about the gravity of the situation and relations is that after years of attempts at reforming SPVM procedures to urge them to take cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women as seriously as they might take cases of white women, is that the person who works on these cases every day is now ahead of the local Defund the Police coalition.
Justice, the peace, abolish the police. people who are in the sex trade, fuck the police. No justice, no peace. Fuck the police.
The coalition of 57 different grassroots groups want to see the police force's budget in the city cut in at least half to be redistributed to other services. That's 57 groups. The SPVM is the second largest municipal police agency in the country behind Toronto, and CTV reports that the SPVM has the biggest police budget in Canada.
Montreal's have spoken that they don't want to spend $665 million on police. That should be reduced. And one of the biggest issues that we could, I know that if we just like invested in housing, we would have a lot less missing cases. And a lot less violence, not only like missing and murdered, but the rates of sexual assault. It just really sometimes comes down to money. And it's money that we have as a society, but we're choosing to spend it in militarizing the police and punitive ways and prisons.
Keanu says the relationship that she has with the SPVM can't be described in one word because it's always different people who are responding to her calls. She has to re-explain the importance of the case, the policing history with Indigenous people, and what this missing and murdered crisis is, depending on who picks up the phone that day. Her relationship with the police as a whole hasn't changed much, she says, since her involvement with the coalition, other than that they're more on the defensive.
They witness a lot of trauma. There's definitely a lot of PTSD within police forces. There's high suicide rates among police officers, addiction rates. You know, there's all of these factors, and it can be just like sometimes a recipe for disaster when you have people who are with such a high stress job, going to situations, dealing with people struggling with in crisis or missing person, all these different things that they have to confront and aren't given, you know, proper support, psychological support within the SPVM. So I think there just needs to be a huge overhaul of the whole system, because to be fair, I feel like police, they're expected to do so many roles that they really shouldn't be doing.
And in these days, the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women is exacerbated by 2021 threats to the social fabric of the city and the pandemic. Nearly 35,000 people identify themselves as Indigenous in the metro area. 2021 rents are on a skyrocket up, and social housing units are perpetually unfinished. The 2021 report says that not only is there less affordable housing, but racist landlords are less likely to rent to an Indigenous person. These life circumstances contribute to the crisis, say many, because without a safe place to live and thrive, there's more risk of danger for these women.
We're talking about housing, we're talking about a Indigenous health center, having more social services, detoxes, rehabilitation, things that are culturally appropriate. Giving people some time to heal from all the intergenerational trauma. And like, I think that, you know, the colonization is ongoing. We're not post-colonization.
This city is also facing a municipal election.
And we're going to like make a candidate take a stand on defunding the police because it just makes no sense.
Hanneberg says elected officials and those with the power must be sure that the Indigenous-led organizations that care for and work with local residents get proper funding to thrive and keep Indigenous women and girls safe. She says the accountability to organizers, to families, and to community leaders is essential.
Because we represent these women. We know what the needs of our women. We know what their realities are.
Like how Indigenous women took it upon themselves to put up and fund a warming tent in Cabot Square in memory of an Anishinaabe Innu man named Raphael Napa Andre this winter. People needed a secure and warm place to go at night, especially those who are homeless amid times of COVID curfew. The tent is staying in the square until at least May 17th, 2021, which is next week. Safety and who gets it and where from is a current debate that many have no time to participate in anymore if it's not backed up with action. Keanu says that people can take just one recommendation in these reports and see how they can use their own tools to bring it about. What do you have in your life right now that would make a difference?
People can just choose like one recommendation and maybe push it. Is it like, and where in your circle do you have some kind of like privilege, you know? And you know, it could be very simple of just educating people around you about this issue. Just sending an email to your city councilor, supporting defunding the police, educating yourself about defunding the police. Like I hear people say, like, you know, just very reactionary, you know, for myself, when the people tell me, do you even know murderers? You're going to allow murderers running around with guns? Like I work with women, families who've had their loved ones who've been murdered and gone missing. Like I know how serious the issue is. So I think it's maybe to learn about the issue and do whatever it is takes, be present when there's gatherings for Indigenous, for MMIW, G2S.
There are ways that lawmakers and government officials must act. It's mandated by international law and by numerous commission reports.
One thing I would like to say is the way that they approach looking for a juvenile in the system, that they have to change some approach on circulating if a youth is under the age of 18, there would be a youth and they go missing, that if the family would like to have their picture put out there so that they can be identified and found. I think it's important that they speed up this process and not have to go through a lengthy court request and wait for a date, because I mean, time is of the essence, you know. For 72 hours, we need to understand what's going on. We want this to happen, but apparently this is the law.
But beyond police, it's also a lot of our laws that are just like rooted in racism, like there are drug laws, like decriminalization of drugs, of all drugs, would have a huge impact on the MMIW G2S crisis.
There are also ways that grassroots can support grassroots.
Well, I think we have to all be aware. We have to be all aware of the risk. We need to educate and sensitize our youth, our women and our men, and also to prepare them to better protect themselves. And I think, you know, buddy systems, there's things like, you know, making sure someone's aware of where you're going at all times, checking in.
There are actions being circulated online, too. Like how people sign petitions to make sure that warming tents stay in the city to keep people safe. And Dana Danger with the Missing Justice Project at Concordia's Center for Gender Advocacy has been organizing for years to bring awareness to this crisis too. For students, actions can also be making sure that you're not opting out of fee levy groups like the volunteer-based and donation-run advocacy center is another way that grassroots matter. Watch and film police interactions with Indigenous or Black Montrealers, or support groups like Stella and Cactus, who are looking out for people who do sex work or use drugs. The Native Women's Shelter and Resilience Montreal also run on volunteer help. There are ways that people have been and continue to point to action to prevent disappearances and keep women safe. This matters, and time is of the essence.
So, and I really think the Indigenous community, if they had the resources, or like, you know, there's ideas in the United States to have a task force. If there could be like maybe a national task force by and for the community, maybe to have access to the same resources as the police to do searches, I think that we would be able to end this crisis, and as well to put all the recommendations from the MMIW G2S inquiry.
If you're listening to this and need to talk to someone about a missing person, want to give information, or just want to get connected with support, a new tip line was launched by the Ishku Project this week. That number for families or any information regarding someone who's gone missing is 1-855-547-5938. Again, 855-547-5938. And representatives from UQAM and Quebec Native Women are going to be doing a webinar about this January 2021 report and their recommendations next week on May 18th at 6 p.m.
And the SPVM acknowledged that that the recommendations made in the report were relevant. So I guess, you know, that at least that's something. Hopefully we're going to learn more about the reaction of the SPVM to the report at that point.
That's May 18th at 6 p.m. And you can find information on how to join at qnw.org. The SPVM responded to questions about this 2021 report. They said they acted on some recommendations from previous reports and put in new procedures into place after signing the 2015 agreement with the network. They said they're working with the Native Friendship Center in Montreal to create mixed patrols of Indigenous intervention workers and officers to answer some calls, and that they could do a better job at communicating the programs that they're currently working on. Quote, the report also highlights actions that still need to be completed or taken, and the solutions appear to us to be legitimate. End quote.
But the work's only beginning, Miigwech.
I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you are listening to CKUT. This is a track called Mestreme by Montreal-based artist Chiquita Magic. Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be tuning into a May 10th conversation by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. They break down what exactly is happening between Israel and Palestine right now. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour, as always, to give you news that you can use right here in Montreal.
We've been witnessing now 54 years of military occupation, 73 years of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And there hasn't been a quiet day in those 73 years or in those 54 years. It just has not been quiet for Palestinians. And yet the framing is always about Israel's security and never about what it means to actually live as a Palestinian, what it's like to be a Palestinian suffering under this very brutal regime.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I am Omar Badar.
And I'm Deanna Boutu.
And today we're going to talk about the latest developments in Palestine as Israel is once again bombing the Gaza Strip, killing at least 20 Palestinians, including 9 children, and wounding dozens others. This comes as Israeli brutality against Palestinian demonstrators in Jerusalem is also escalating, with countless videos showing unarmed Palestinians suffering ruthless beatings by Israeli police, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque attacked once again. But Deanna, let's start with the horrific developments in Gaza, with just really horrific images emerging of Israel's bombing that has killed many children. What do you make of what's unfolding?
This, Omar, has been part of Netanyahu's ongoing strategy. He has survived all of these years in office, including through corruption charges, by pointing to three different things. One is Iran, the second is Hezbollah, and the third is Hamas. And all that he does is whenever there is some crisis that he's facing domestically, he stirs up commotion so that he can point to one of these three things. And this time it was specifically in relation to Gaza. It makes absolutely no sense that Israel is allowed to bomb Gaza, kill 20 Palestinians, including 9 children, and get away with it. There are no excuses for this type of behavior, but it's because of the fact that he has been coddled and and the world has allowed this to happen, that he's going to continue to do this. And the expressions of deeply concerned that we saw over the weekend as he had unleashed Israeli forces on people who were praying at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holiest days of Ramadan, that was met with deep concern. And yet here we are now with him bombing Gaza, and it won't even so much as make waves among diplomats, with instead them condemning the actions of Palestinian factions rather than condemning Israel's actions.
And the truly frustrating part, Diana, is that the status quo, when allegedly nothing is happening, is still occupation and apartheid. So the so-called normal is already violence against Palestinians. And then you have Israel further escalating by pushing Palestinians out of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah and unleashing unspeakable brutality against Palestinians. And that barely gets mentioned. But then inevitably there is a Palestinian violent response somewhere. And in this case, it's rockets from Gaza. And now everyone's talking about it. And when Israel responds by massacring Palestinian children, this gets framed simply as a reaction to Palestinian violence. And you see it in the infuriating discrepancy in Washington's response, merely expressing concern about Israel's widespread violence, but reserving the harshest condemnations for when Palestinians are violent.
Yes, and it's even beyond that, Omar. It's what gets reported and what doesn't get reported, and the way that things get reported. For example, I'm still waiting to meet a doctor who can describe what a clash is, because Palestinians seem to die from something called clashes that doesn't really seem to affect other people around the world. In other words, there's always a passive voice that is used when it comes to Palestinians, when it comes to Israel, directly targeting Palestinians. That's always expressed in the passive voice rather than in the active voice. And then terms like unrest, which its opposite implies that there has been rest. It implies that there's been peace. And as you know, there hasn't been peace. We've been witnessing now 54 years of military occupation, 73 years of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And there hasn't been a quiet day in those 73 years or in those 54 years. It just has not been quiet for Palestinians. And yet the framing is always about Israel's security and never about what it means to actually live as a Palestinian, what it's like to be a Palestinian suffering under this very brutal regime. Even the basics, Omar, of being able to pray, to fast, as you know, these are the last few days of Ramadan. And during Ramadan, Palestinians are fasting. The vast majority of Palestinians are fasting. Just that simple act of being able to fast and pray in our holy sites is something that gets turned into, just that simple act is something that gets turned into an act of brutality by Israel. They don't even allow us the simple pleasure of being able to fast in peace, of being able to pray in peace, of being able to worship in peace. Even that is taken away from us.
And you can imagine what the reaction would have been if the situation were reversed, if armed Palestinians were invading Jewish places of worship and brutalizing and kidnapping unarmed Israelis on camera. I mean, the condemnation would have been universal, and the footage would be playing on a loop on breaking news on just about every outlet. But just to set a little bit more context, all of this is happening on the back of the attempted evictions in Sheikh Jarrah. Can you describe what's happening there?
Yes, definitely. Over the course of more than a decade now, the Israelis have been trying to evict more than two dozen families from Sheikh Jarrah. And I think we also have a podcast on this, Omar, that you and I did together, interviewing Fayrou Sharkawi from Grassroots Al-Quds, and you interviewing Mohammed Al-Kurd, one of those who are affected by these evictions. Mm-hmm. And in this context, what has been happening is that we've seen that the process has been a slow and very deliberate one. And the reason that it's been slow is because the aim is to try to remove any momentum from these protests. It's to try to make it so that these these evictions, this ethnic cleansing is just normalized. And they've tried to turn it into some private housing dispute. Now, what's happened is that the date of the final eviction was supposed to be on May the 2nd, which was just a few days ago, a little over a week ago. And there was starting to be a series of massive protests with people actively taking to the streets, protesting in front of these houses in Sheikh Jarrah, carrying signs that said, "Save Sheikh Jarrah." Each and every one of these protests was met with some form of violence on the part of the Israeli forces, including during one of the protests when we saw that the Israeli police even attacked a Jewish Israeli member of Knesset who happens to be part of the joint list. And so we saw that these violent acts have been escalating and escalating and escalating, where the police have been effectively given carte blanche. They've been given an open slate to do whatever it is that they want to do against protesters. Add to this the fact that, so from that, we then saw that with the election of these extreme right wingers, for example, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the man who claims that his hero is Baruch Goldstein, or Smotrich himself, we saw that these individuals also became involved and then started calling for protests in Jerusalem, where there were these massive rallies with the slogan of "Death to Arabs." And again, these protests were allowed to happen in East Jerusalem, with all of these settlers allowed to not only run freely throughout the streets, but allowed to terrorize Palestinians in the process. And this, of course, has been going on for now 54 years, where we see that the settlers are given the ability to do whatever it is that they want to do. They now have police protection in addition to sanction support by several members of Knesset, such as Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, where it came to the point where over the course of the past few days, the Israelis didn't just stop at harassing Palestinians, chanting "death to Arabs" against Palestinians, but also took to really attacking them. And the massive attacks came over the weekend when Israel tried to block the ability of Palestinians to get to Al-Aqsa. They've been trying to do this all throughout the month of Ramadan. And once again, they tried to block access to Al-Aqsa because during these last 10 days of Ramadan, Palestinians go to Al-Aqsa and they stay for the last 10 days, sometimes for 2 days, sometimes for three days, sometimes for 10 days, spending all of this time in Al-Aqsa in worship. And Israel once again tried to block this, and they did this by firing stun grenades, by firing these, what they call sponge bullets, but are hardly have any sponge on them, by firing live ammunition in some cases. And we've seen the number of injured has been skyrocketing, with some people even losing their eyes because they've been shot in the face. In fact, the vast majority of injuries have been to the head and to the eyes throughout this period. So all of this is for one reason only, and that's because of today. Today being May the 10th. May the 10th falls on the Hebrew calendar as being Jerusalem Day. And Jerusalem Day is a celebration, and yes, it's a celebration for them, of 54 years of military occupation. And on Jerusalem Day, the Israeli settlers once again do a rampage throughout the streets of Jerusalem, again chanting "death to Arabs," priding themselves on what they call the unification of Jerusalem, when in fact all that they're really celebrating is the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the theft of homes, of Palestinian homes, land theft, the denial of freedom of Palestinians. And so all of these measures of attempting to block Palestinians from being on the Al-Aqsa compound was simply to be able to facilitate this massive parade, not only through the streets of the old city, but getting to Al-Aqsa itself. And this has been part of the government's program and plan from the very beginning.
Welcome back to CKUT. I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you were just listening to a May 10th podcast from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. If you want to hear more or connect with them, they're at imeu.org. imeu.org. And before we go, some news that you can use. This week, Trans Estrie and Le Conseil Québécois LGBT published a new medical transition guide. It's a website with information on medical procedures for trans people in Quebec. They're presenting it and sharing stories from people who've transitioned on May 20th at 7 p.m. You can find more information on that webinar on their Facebook page, Trans Estrie. TRANSESTRIE. And on Saturday, there will be at least two protests in Montreal. One is co-hosted by Montreal's Palestine Youth Movement. And it's in support of Palestinians in Parc Lafontaine at 11 a.m. And 12 immigration or rights community groups are going to be protesting on the same day for a, quote, more humane immigration system, end quote. They say they want the province to rectify new, stricter immigration reforms, unreasonable processing times for permanent residency, and more. That's at 2 p.m. at 1010 Rue Saint-Antoine West. And to lead us out,
I'm Eve Parker Finley. I'm a musician, comedian, multimedia maker, CKUT radio host. CBC is running a competition called CBC Searchlight to elevate emerging musicians across the country. I'm one of those musicians, and you can vote for me right now. Just look up CBC Searchlight and you can find the voting link there. The first round of voting ends on May 20th, and you can vote once per day per device. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, and Joel Somadol. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram, we're at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook, search for CKUT. I'm Eve Parker Finley, keep it tuned at CKUT.
Well,
Bienvenue à votre émission préférée d'art et culture, Café à CKUT 90.3. Ce soir, l'émission est en trois actes. D'abord, Alex nous parlera du film Pour l'éternité, du réalisateur Roy Anderson. De mon côté, j'aimerais vous parler de la pièce de théâtre, ou plutôt du spectacle-lecture La Renarde et le Mal peigné, qui va être en webdiffusion dès ce soir au Théâtre du Nouveau Monde. Et Marc-Antoine nous présente une belle entrevue avec des membres de la coopérative de tatouage Crève-Cœur. Donc, commençons sans plus tarder avec la bande-annonce du film Pour l'éternité. Bonne émission!
Vad ska man göra när man har förlorat sin tro?
Jag är ledsen, men vi håller på att stänga nu.
Ah!
Det är där som spökar.
Jag är rädd för spöken.
Ja, ni får gå ändå.
Åh, Gud, min Gud.